DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum on DW, your one-stop shop for all the latest in science and technology. I'm Zulfikar Abani, and coming up, how mobile technology can be used to help in the treatment of HIV/AIDS. Then we go on a dig at Messel near Frankfurt, the pit that brought you copulating turtle fossils.
I found old spiders, and it's amazing. You just see these old rocks, and suddenly there's a small animal. Really, you can see the details of it, and it's really nice.
And the world's lightest material, aerographite. All that and more right here on Spectrum. But first, with over 21,000 delegates in Washington for a major conference on HIV/AIDS research, scientists seem to be feeling a strong urge to say that they have reached a turning point. That's been their message this week so far. In the past 30 years, more than 30 million people have died as a result of HIV/AIDS. Current estimates from the United Nations suggest that a further 34.2 million are living with HIV, the virus that can lead to AIDS. But not even half that number are being treated. Treatment, of course, is not only about access to affordable drugs. It also involves the flow of information, test results and medical advice. Just getting that right can be a challenge in countries that lack infrastructure. But there's a growing use of so-called mHealth techniques, using mobile devices to enhance efficiency. The US-based Futures Group hopes to use mobile technology to stem the transmission of HIV from mothers to their children. And they've tested their data monitoring and reporting tools in African countries. I spoke to Bobby Jefferson of Futures Group ahead of a presentation at the Washington AIDS Conference.
We used mobile phones that the community health workers and the nurses that they currently have in their possession. We don't use any advanced smartphones or any advanced technology. It's the mobile phone technology that they currently have and that they're familiar with. And we set up the system to allow them to send in reports and to be able to track the antenatal care and the PMTCT care that the mothers and babies are receiving at the clinic or the facility. And they send that data in by SMS. And it's sent immediately and directly to the Ministry of Health and the District Health Office. Once the data now is received by mobile phone, it's then acted upon in a much more real-time manner, both by the ministry and the district office.
So we're talking about speed and efficiency here, and you have designed your tools primarily, it seems, for use where infrastructure is underdeveloped. This has been tested in 5 countries, I believe. Can you give us an idea of where you've tested this and how the results look?
So we've tested in Tanzania, Kenya, Zambia, and Nigeria. We started off as a pilot 2-3 years ago in Tanzania with approximately 20 to 30 sites. And now we're up to 760 sites that are reporting by using their mobile phone in Tanzania. So we are really at scale, and we've learned some lessons across those countries of the sort of barriers and limitations, which in a low-resource setting, and it's not the technology. It's all about the people. It's about the training, the support, and providing them the tools that they need to send in the information correctly and accurately.
And I imagine you mentioned some East African states, of course, Nigeria as well. There's a relatively high prevalence of mobile devices there. What about in countries in areas where coverage is not so good?
So in countries that have very sparse mobile phone coverage, the system allows for data to be captured or SMS to be captured offline. And so they can store and record it on their mobile phone. And then when they get into an area that has better coverage, then the system automatically sends the data to the ministry and to the district office. The other part is that the software is completely open source and free. So any hospital, any facility, any country can use the system. It's not proprietary to us or to our program at all.
And so what sort of an effect have you seen in the treatment of people? What sort of benefits are we talking about here?
The type of data that we're tracking is the mothers who are tested and when they, for example, don't receive tests. And that could be attributed to, for example, that there's not enough HIV test kits or the hospital facility didn't have enough fuel or gen to have power. And so the benefit is that those are now immediately alerted, both at the ministry and the district office, to be able to resupply those clinics and hospital facilities with the HIV test kits or with reagents or with the needed resources, rather than waiting the months and months that they used to do in the old days. Now they can get the resources to them a lot sooner because they know where the inefficiencies are in the process. So this really helps the facilities and the antenatal care centers to really be able to see and address the patients and their needs, and not have to worry so much about, you know, the issues associated with lack of supplies or that no one's going to know or listen to them. They know that now everyone that has the data in front of them is going to act on it.
And I suppose then there would be applications, of course, in some Asian countries and also perhaps the Pacific as well.
Absolutely. So the countries that have a bit more resources, the Asian countries, India, Thailand, they absolutely can use exactly the same solution, and they would have, and they have better infrastructure, so they can get even gain much more efficiencies. But the key we still see, whether or not it's mobile phones or other technology, is that it must be a country-led or ministry-led solution, that they have to have ownership. So the technology that should be chosen, whether or not it's Africa or Asia, should be the technology that the countries can sustain.
Bobby Jefferson of Futures Group on the line there from Washington. Now, on a slightly different tack, the fossilised remains of turtles having sex, you may remember, made headlines around the world last month. The turtles are the only known examples of animals with backbones that have been preserved while copulating. The 48-million-year-old fossils came from a disused quarry called Messel in the centre of Germany, near Frankfurt. Messel is a UNESCO World Heritage Site and one of the most famous fossil pits in the world. Our reporter Kate Hairsine went along for a look behind the scenes with the fossil diggers.
Paleontologist Sonja Vedman unlocks the iron security gate at the top of the Messel pit and turns her four-wheel drive down a bumpy road.
And now we have a nice view into the Messel pit.
We look down into a 1 kilometre wide and 60 metre deep pit. Although now green with trees, the pit was originally created by mining for brown coal and oil shale. The mining trucks moved on 40 years ago, and after a successful fight by the scientific community to stop the pit being turned into a garbage dump, the site is reserved exclusively for fossil research. We park next to a group from the Senckenberg Research Institute, who have been hard at work looking for fossils since 7 a.m. this morning.
I'm using my spade to loosen larger blocks of oil shale from the underlying rock bed and then sliding them down the slope to my colleagues to load onto their wheelbarrows. We'll then examine these rocks for fossils.
That's Bruno Zehr. Officially, he's a fossil preparer that spends his summers excavating for the Senckenberg Institute at the Messel pit. He takes a seat on a plastic chair, lines up a wheelbarrow full of rock next to him, and starts wedging apart layers of rock sediment with a large yellow-handled kitchen knife. He flicks the discarded pieces of shale onto the ground in front of him.
To get a sense of what an oil shale is, you have to picture a sealed book where the pages are stuck together. Now we have to slide our knives down the side of every single page, that is, every layer of sediment, and open it up. And in between the pages is where you find the fossils.
Suchen wir dann nach Fossilien.
The fossil hunters here sit in the sun and split rocks for hours at a time. That is, when they're not digging. Intern Juliana Kehrer has been working in Messel for nearly 4 weeks. Despite her sore back and aching hands, she says she's enjoying her time here.
It's really interesting to be here because it's really old, once living animals, and I found old spiders, and it's amazing. You just see these old rocks and suddenly there's a small animal. Really, you can see the details of it, and it's really nice.
Messel formed about 48 million years ago when a violent volcanic eruption created a deep crater that soon filled with water to make a lake. Tens of thousands of preserved plant and animal species, from palms to beetles, bats and birds, fish, hedgehogs and crocodiles, have already been excavated from sediment layers that once formed the bed of this ancient lake.
Sit down. You're
Paleontologist Sonja Wedman walks over to see what fossils the group have found today.
The fossils which are found, they are kept underwater.
Why on earth are they kept underwater?
Because the oil shale has a high water content, and if it dries out, it cracks up, and all fossils which are on the surface also get cracks and get destroyed. So we keep everything wet. The smaller pieces in these buckets with water and bigger pieces, they are wrapped in wet paper and then brought to the preparation station.
What have they found over here?
I want to have a nice one. These are different kind of leaves. So they are always partly under the oil shale, so they all have to be prepared, and it takes a lot of time to uncover them completely.
It seems strange for the fossils to be sitting in white plastic buckets. They're some of the world's most famous fossils and have been preserved exquisitely. Not only have researchers found whole skeletons here, but also, on rare occasions, the preserved outlines of fur, feathers and skin, as well as stomach contents, and even the fetus of an ancient horse still in its mother's stomach.
Oh,
what have you found there?
Ein kleiner Fisch. Hier ist das Auge, der guckt sie quasi noch an.
It's a fish. It's looking at you. See, here is the backbone and the tail is there too. I'm going to measure it and then enter it into the dig log book. And then I'll pack him up and he'll be stored in the preservation room until we've finished excavating at the end of summer. And then he can be prepared.
Bis die Grabung zu Ende ist und dann kann präpariert werden.
Bruno Zehr sits back down and continues splitting shale. His job, he says, requires steady hands, a light touch, and an enormous amount of patience. And he's got that in spades. Or should that be trowels? This is Kate Hairsign for DW in the Messel Pit near Frankfurt.
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
It's thought that more and more students are becoming victims of cyberbullying, and an EU-funded programme is trying to combat bullying on the internet. It's currently being trialled in the German capital, Berlin. DW's Richard Fuchs has been investigating. Holly Cooper has his report.
It's 11 o'clock in the morning at the Sophie Scholl School in Berlin's Schöneberg district. Teacher Margaret Iverson, a woman in her mid-50s with a short pageboy haircut, talks to the 8th grade class during her ethics lesson on the dark side of the internet. Cyberbullying and the spreading of rumors and threats on the net. It's a touchy subject, as the ethics teacher found out.
Sie empfinden das unheimlich stark als ihre Welt.
They feel incredibly strongly that this is their world. They believe that this is the world of their age group, the social network, and they don't want this to enter the classroom.
Sie wollen nicht, dass man das betritt.
Entering the cyber world to understand and learn. That is the idea behind a school project called Media Heroes. It is funded by the European Union and monitored by developmental psychologists from the Free University in Berlin. 900 students in the German capital, from the 7th to the 9th grade, have completed the program so far. 14 and 15-year-old students Katarina and Josephine are in Margaret Iverson's class and are going through the program now. Anonymous insults via text message or embarrassing photos on Facebook. Sadly, that's part of everyday life for the students.
Der Begriff Cybermobbing.
I knew a little bit about the concept of cyberbullying before because there were a few incidents in my old school that were never really handled by the school before.
There was even an incident in our class. There was a hate group against a girl, but I won't say any more about that here.
Gegen ein Mädchen, aber ja.
In order to break the silence of the students about cyberbullying, teacher Margaret Iverson uses cooperation rather than confrontation. Instead of arguing about perpetrators and victims, she wants to first work on the students' practical media skills.
As a teacher, you have the problem of being ignorant because the students are actually ahead of us.
So, Iverson receives support from Pavel Zagorchak. He is an undergraduate student and employee in the Department of Developmental Psychology at the Free University in Berlin. He helped design the Lessons for Media Heroes project, carried out teacher training courses, and visited teachers during the implementation process. His conclusion is that there is still a digital divide between teachers and parents on one side and young people on the other side. He has gotten a lot of questions about Facebook and Twitter in particular.
It's not about parents or teachers being experts. It's more important that they develop a degree of openness and that they know at least some important keywords. The fact that you know what my child is talking about or what my student is saying builds credibility with the teacher. Of course, we must offer further training for this, which we will do in the teacher training courses.
The Media Heroes Project was launched by Professor Herbert Scheithauser. He developed the prevention program as part of an EU-wide project that is also being carried out in Italy, Spain, Greece, and England. Above all, it is important that developmental psychology introduces teachers to the world of young people. At the same time, students should learn from each other through so-called peer-to-peer methods.
A group of students create a clever example of how safety features on social networking sites can help optimize their profiles. Then in the next hour, these students explain to their peers how to use these features by showing them on the computer.
After 2 years of preparation and a two-month trial period, the project has been accepted. Scientific evaluations indicate that the program works. However, there is still a long way to go until the Media Heroes Project reaches every student in Germany. The project must reach approximately 11 million students to be completed. A mammoth task, even for Media Heroes.
Holly Cooper with that report there by Richard Fuchs. You're listening to Spectrum with me, Zulfikar Abani, on DW. Online, we're at dw.de/spectrum. And you can, of course, follow us at DW_SciTech. Engineers at the German universities of Kiel and Hamburg say they've discovered the world's lightest material, aerographite. It's super strong and very flexible too. Although 99.9% of aerographite is made of air, the new material gets its strength from a three-dimensional carbon network. It makes aerographite 75 times lighter than styrofoam. It was discovered by chance by PhD student Matthias Mecklenburg in September 2010. Since then, he and his mentor, Professor Karl Schulte of Hamburg University, have been working with their colleagues at the Christian Albrechts University in Kiel, who provided the impetus, actually, for the original experiments which led to the discovery. They've just presented their findings in the journal Advanced Materials, and I spoke to Professor Karl Schulte about aerographite, the world's lightest material.
The material is a carbon-based material, and this carbon-based material has a graphene-like structure. And the graphene-like structure is highly porous and therefore forms a three-dimensional carbon network. And that makes it so light and gives it some specific properties.
And you said that this material is basically almost entirely made of air because of the structure.
Yeah, one can say that, because if it's so light, then it means we have somehow the air, and then inside and around the air we have the structure of the carbon. One can describe that somehow as the Eiffel Tower or the Tour Eiffel, and then you know there it's only somehow a lightweight structure because you have all these various bars connected together and in between is air. If it would have been massive material, it would weigh much more.
Now, you've called your material aerographite.
Yes.
It is better than an earlier material, aerogel. Can you tell us exactly how did you come about discovering this? Because it was not what you were setting out to do, was it?
We were studying some three-dimensional material. And the three-dimensional material was produced in Kiel at the university here, the local university, in the group of Mr. Adelung. And they formed a zinc oxide material, and the zinc oxide material was three-dimensionally structured, but it was a massive material. And then we both came together and said, okay, why not to use this material and try to put it in a reactor where we could grow on that material probably carbon nanotubes. We call that the speciality we have in Hamburg. And then we looked into the reactor, and later we saw a result, and then we could see that part of the zinc oxide suddenly disappeared. However, at those locations where before had been the zinc oxide, we had now a very small see-through coverage of a material. And then in a later investigation, we could find out that this was a carbon-like material. And then later, we could also see that it was a graphene structure. So that means the old material just disappeared. And we had then around that, where it formerly was, we had then this carbon structure.
So a pleasant surprise in a way. Give us an idea of what this material can be used for, because it's, as you say, it's incredibly light, it's incredibly strong, but it could be also be scrunched up, as far as I understand.
Yes, it's light. It's, in that sense, it's incredibly strong, not as the total material, but only due to the fact there where you have the carbon bonds, they are very strong. However, then the main material and the graphene structures, they are very thin. And that means it's a flexible material with a strength sufficiently good and, very important, it also has electrical conductivity. Therefore, our first idea was and is still to use this material, for instance, for batteries. If you have lithium-ion batteries, then you can, for instance, makes them lighter or you can produce them with a higher capacity. And that is, for the first moment, our first idea of an application to use it there.
And are there any other applications that you can think of right now? Because I mean, if you think about batteries, I imagine that hopefully this material would make sure that they leak less as well, that they're less toxic for us.
We have, of course, also other ideas in mind. One could be to use this material also in supercapacitors, because it also has a very high surface area, beside the fact that it is electrically conductive. Then we want to use it and have very first results where we fill the rest of the material, so replace the air by a polymer, and then we achieve a polymer which is electrically conductive and achieves a relatively good conductivity. And that's one application where it might be used to get rid of static charges of some material, might be used then also in satellites where you need both stiffness and electrical conductivity.
So what's the next step now before this gets onto the market? How quickly can we see this?
The next steps are now to investigate the material in more detail. So that means, first of all, we have to optimize the production routes. That means for the template and also for the aerographite. Then the second step would be to increase the yield of the material, and that also in a standardized property.
Professor Karl Schulte of Hamburg University there. On another note, I've got to say thanks just for a moment to Anne Clay in the United States, who got in touch about our coverage of CERN's discovery of a new particle earlier this month, possibly a Higgs boson, you might remember. Glad you liked it, Anne, but sorry to hear so many others near you seem to be more interested in Kim Kardashian's love life. But then perhaps she does hold all the answers to mass. You never know. Thanks also to Mr. Yamaguchi, who didn't provide a first name but lives in Japan. I couldn't agree more about Tron being influential for CGI film as well as Pixar. I remember the original Tron very well. Watched it down at Hendon Central when I think I might have been about 8 years old. Now, another change of tack from things that make you go wow to things that make you go ooh. Virologists here in Germany recently discovered that bats carry a far wider spectrum of viruses than previously thought, like strains of mumps that can potentially cross to humans. Much like humans, bats frequently live in dense communities that make it easy for viruses to spread. So are we perhaps underestimating their role for a trigger for disease outbreaks among us? Sonia Dean reports.
It's around sundown, and I've come with some bat conservationists to the juncture of the Rhine and Sieg rivers near Bonn in Germany. The place is swarming with insects, which means it's a good hunting ground for bats. Martin Koch, a biologist, explains the plan.
We're going to stretch an extremely fine net over the Sieg in the hope of catching a female water bat. Once we've caught her, we'll find out where the nursery roost is to protect it.
So we've just crossed over a small bridge. There are really a lot of insects here, and it feels quite warm and buggy, in fact, and it's getting ever darker. A lot of birds and trees in the area, and they are pulling out the nets in order to stretch them across the water.
Jens Strassburger is another biologist out here tonight.
That's the echolocation call of the bat. This ultrasound device renders the call 10 times slower than its original speed, so humans can hear it at all. Here's what it sounds like without being slowed.
Knistern, ja. Knistern. Genau.
As the last light is disappearing, we've seen the bats, we've heard the bats, and now we're just waiting for them to go into the net. Not only conservationists are interested in bats. Here in Bonn University's Institute of Virology, they're preparing equipment for a test.
You set up a net and you wait for bats to fly in, and then you take them out of the nets, you keep them waiting for a few minutes to calm down, and then you take the bats out of the cloth bag in your hand, and you will find probably within the cloth bag or even within your hand a little bit of bat feces, and these are our main sample type for the study.
Okay, so you basically scared them into pooing.
And yes. Which doesn't take much.
Christian Drosten is the head of the institute and lead author on new research, suggesting that bats carry a wider spectrum of viruses than previously thought, including a strain of mumps nearly identical to the one that infects humans. But he doesn't see bats as a threat.
Whether bats are dangerous for humans? Well, I mean, there are some 2 or 3 documented cases of bat rabies across Europe within the last 10 years. If you think that's a danger, okay, then bats are dangerous to humans. This is a thing I can tell for sure, that we are dangerous to the bats because we take their resources.
Virologist Christian Drosten hopes people don't misunderstand his team's research to shoo bats away from their gardens or local parks.
Biodiversity really prevents pandemics. So the preservation of biodiversity and habitats, this will probably dilute pathogens in these ecosystems and, of course, prevent them from emerging and from switching hosts.
Back at the Zieg River with the biologist, we're in luck. Our nets have landed a catch.
It's got an elevated pulse. Water bats have big feet. And let's have a look. Female. Very good. Should be radio tagged.
Not only is it female, it's also pregnant. Jackpot for finding the nursery roost. Here's where the radio receiver comes into play. Trussberger gently affixes it to the back of the female water bat with some special skin glue that won't harm her. The device will fall off after a few days. After the glue dries, it's time to let her go. Sonja Dean, DW.
Woo!
Well, that's just about all from Spectrum on DW for now. Don't forget, you can always keep up with our stuff at dw.de/science. Listen again or download the podcast at dw.de/spectrum. I'm Zulfi Karabani. Studio tech was Matt Grieber. Next week, the DNA of a banana. Until then, we're going to go on out with Tim Rogers, a legend from Kalgoorlie, but I believe unrelated to our other digger reporter, Kate. Anyway, thanks for listening. Bye for now. Come on back, make a home with me. I'm the
bristle in your tenderloin, the 20-cent coin that's rolled down the crease of your setting. But when you fry those bigger fish, I'll still be hot here in the pan.